Okay, everybody. Are we all in? Are we all here? Physically? Mentally? Hello? Okay, guys, I'm really upset. You guys aren't living up to your part of the bargain. Here we put you in a luxury hotel, we give you fancy food, fancy wine, great beer, and I only got one question. And the guy came and took it back half an hour later. So, I've arranged some provocation today. And, first of all, I'm going to set some homework. So you all have to do something by Thursday. Okay? And I'm now going to explain what you have to do. So,
survive, I guess.
Survive.
Okay, are we supposed to supply a specimen?
Okay, no. So, okay, so, David, please. Okay, so this is what we've learned so far, that we as a field in electron microscopy start off with a specimen. This is the letter to nature view of our field. We start off with a specimen, and then we tiptoe past this big black box, and we end up with a three-dimensional map. And it sort of goes like, we are interested in this wonderfully exciting virus, which we get from our buddy in New Zealand. Forget that stuff. That's all in the supplementary materials. And we end up with a three-dimensional map at 3.689 angstroms resolution, which was just beautiful.
Sad but true.
Sad but true. Okay, so we're covering up a lot of stuff in here, and we need to figure out what to do about it. Okay, so there's lots going on. But, you know, you paint a picture with a broad brush, and here's the broad brush picture of what we do. Okay, so we start off with a specimen. We somehow get to an image. Then we crunch some numbers, and we get a three-dimensional map. And there's lots of damage going on over here. You know, and I've sort of put this damage in various groupings, and I'll go through them in a minute. You may not agree with all this, but this is sort of this sort of overview. So the message that I've gotten so far is that it's definitely possible to get from there to there at very high resolution. It's amazing. It's absolutely beautiful. So somehow one can thread their way through this morass of damage and crunch a bunch of numbers and get to the three-dimensional map. And my impression is that this computational side of things is pretty much taken care of, you know. If you get great images, you can get great maps. So there's undoubtedly things to be improved here, but for the most part, let's say that that's taken care of. So then there's the specimen and getting to the image, and there are lots of things that are going on here. There are things that I call biological damage, and those are, roughly speaking, conformational variability and compositional variability. And we heard this morning... I call it damage, yeah. I mean, you want something that's like rock solid. You don't want it to sort of move around, or you don't want it to vary in terms of its subunit composition. That kind of messes things up. Okay, so, but we can sort this out. You know, we can take care of this. The number crunchers can sort. So I actually think that, you know, to a large extent, this is not that big a problem. It's, you know. Let me finish. Jeez, God. Now I've got them going. Okay, so then there's freezing damage, and that's, you know, interactions with the grid, surface interactions. I don't think that's under control at all. That's the sort of message that I was getting. And then there's electron damage, which is classical radiation damage. And we heard a talk from James on that. And that looks incredibly promising. Probably still some work to do there. And then there's the question of, you know, things moving around under the influence of the beam, which we put under the heading of translations, rotations, and charging. And that's not really understood very well. And then there's what I call optical damage. Don't get upset. And optical damage is, you know, things that are out of focus, astigmatic, there's a contrast transfer function involved. There are all these contrast mechanisms that we won't mention. But I think, you know, it is possible to get through all this. And I think that, you know, that is pretty much under control, too. I mean, there are improvements to be made there as well. But I think, you know, there's a lot of work being done. So let's forget about that. I really think that this is where we have no clue what we're doing. So my challenge to you is, by Thursday, come up with some experiments that we can all do. And I'm going to pick on people at random to stand up and tell me what their experiments are. And I'm going to pick on the senior people, like Bob.
The more vocal ones.
Two slides, Bob. And Richard, and Yoshi, and Nigel, and David, and Ken. I mean, so, huh? You're leaving on Wednesday? No, I think we can come up with a few experiments that people could do. I wanted to add that, you know, these are experiments that need to be done, but this is not going to get you tenure, you young guys. That's the unfortunate message. You know, this needs to be done, but if you write an NIH grant on this, I'm sure it won't be funded. At least I don't think it'll be funded. And even if you succeed, the people in your cell biology department will fall off their seats in boredom when you give a talk. So the young guys who are heading for tenure shouldn't do this. The established labs with lots of technicians should do this. So I think that's my challenge. So Thursday, we're going to hear what your homework, what you've come up with in terms of your homework. So Mark is going to give an introduction. And Liz is then going to talk about ways that she's developed over the years to make specimens. And then Vincennes is going to talk as well.
There's a capital R in my name.
Oh, sorry. It's conformational variability. It's just like, you know, it's another isoform.
It goes along with better specimens.
Ron sent out a group email 6 weeks ago and just asked for provocative ideas for discussion, and hence the editorial that I sent all of you, which some of you may agree with or not. But I feel compelled to begin by saying that the beautiful work from Nico's lab is bovine rotavirus. A. R. Bellamy. And Richard has sent samples all over the planet, and he's told me over a few Steinlagers that his nightmare in life is that the tens of milligrams of virus that he's sent throughout the planet will end up being acknowledged in a supplement or maybe a figure legend, and possibly not even co-authorship. But I would argue is we saw Bridget's slide with the Eppendorf, and going from here to a map at high resolution. Some would say that 90% of the effort is getting to here, and that's one of the points I want to make, that Richard and Nigel showed us in 1975 that if you have a Phillips 300 and a wonderful specimen, you can visualize alpha helices. This is something my father would always say. And again, Dr. Bellamy provided this beautiful, clean, homogeneous, largely stable specimen that resulted in the wonderful map that Nico showed. So the ugly, human beings overestimate what will be done in the short term. And Bob mentioned that he's ebullient over his grant. So let's say he's working on a project, year one, purify, figure out freezing, imaging conditions, map, 4 years. But you don't have 4 years, Bob. It's more like this. So purify, freeze, map, start getting the preliminary data for your competitive renewal, which goes in year four. But unfortunately, for many of us, we've encountered projects where you get the grant and then it becomes pure. It could be clone, express, purify, a different conformational state, a different ligand, but yeah, you never even get to the microscope. So I'd like to follow on with that to the good, and in fact, I would say the truly outstanding monumental achievements in our field. Bacteria rhodopsin, Werner's work on light harvesting complex, zinc tubulin sheets from Ken Downing's lab, AQP0, wonderful story of three-dimensional structure of a membrane from Thomas Waltz's lab. We heard Nigel's beautiful story about the acetylcholine receptor, the flagellar filaments, also going to high resolution. And then just this morning, we saw an example of the ability to resolve amino acid side chains by analysis of icosahedral viruses. Also beautiful work on GROEL. And Steve Lutke has also used this as a test specimen. And I also want to point out that Nico was describing this trimer, which is VP6. And in the original paper, Wachu and Steve Lutke tested EMAN using a PDB file on a homologous trimeric protein. It was blue tongue VP7. Molecular weight, it's pretty small. But the particle itself was sort of 60 kD. Is that right, Nico, for the trimer? Yeah. What's the
final VP6 alone is 100.
Okay. So it's 300.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you look at Steve's paper, you know, adding a fair bit of noise, they were able to achieve simulations where you could resolve secondary structure by single particle analysis. And I think it's computational achievements like that that keep driving us to smaller and smaller objects. But even so, it really, really hasn't been achieved. The point I'm making here is that, again, this is presenting my own biases, but I think the truly outstanding achievements in the field have been on specimens that manifest symmetry. And some of the points here I put in the sort of editorial, and you've heard them presented by several people through the meeting. Radiation sensitivity, is there some protection provided by working at helium temperature? Is there a way to chemically modify proteins to make them more radiation resistant, antioxidants? I actually think Ron wanted me to present this part of the meeting here because I'm sort of empathic about having experienced some radiation damage myself from having skied too much at high altitude. Stability of complexes, as we heard during Debbie's talk, that, of course, if you can't purify a complex, you'll never be able to freeze it. Subunit size, of course, an important factor, and on down the list. So I think we have to worry a lot about radiation sensitivity. If we were looking at alloys, our lives would be much easier. And so here we have a high-dose image and a low-dose image. Of course, this was the first image, the second image. But even so, this has enough information to sort of get preliminary alignments started. And, you know, publishable. Who knows, you know, if it's a really hot novel protein. There are more stain papers being published now. I can't figure this out. High dose, low dose, stability. For instance, for membrane proteins, you use a harsh detergent, it'll denature, nice, gentle, non-ionic detergent to maintain native conformation can be critically important. Or you could say freezing. Here we are at the air-water interface, and Bob would say that this is what your protein looks like. But if you're able to immerse your specimen within the vitrified buffer, then native structure is maintained. Although, you know, there could still be some beam damage here, even under low-dose conditions. Size, so here's the scale bar. So imagine the technical challenge if the scale bar is 10 angstroms versus 100 angstroms. So 100 angstroms, it's sort of in the category of GRO-EL. You can achieve sub-5 angstrom resolution. If this is now 40, 50, 60 angstroms across, like many ion channels that are being examined, I'm not aware of any potassium channel, voltage-gated channel, where alpha helices have been visualized by single particle methods. I should add, you know, there are also cofactors involved for stability, we see, and ligands, other species that may be interacting with the complex. All these may be important for understanding the biology of the system. Often just the shape may confound your project. We've worked on some viruses that were very smooth, didn't have nice surface knobs and spikes like hepatitis B that allowed you to nail the orientations. And if you have roughly smooth particles, it can be very difficult to determine the Euler angles. Imagine here, let's say this is a new kind of channel, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So this could be staph alpha toxin, right? But it has some other isoform here. And at low resolution, it'll look pretty circular, very difficult to determine orientations. There's a lot of discussion about purification by computation. And I would argue that if your contaminants are on the order of the same size of the material you're trying to image, that computational methods may fail, that I would endeavor to purify your specimens as best as you can while maintaining function. But even here, let's say this is a complex, it's been histagged, it's pure, it's homogeneous monodisperse, but one of the subunits, you know, has been cleaved, proteolized. The histag is present on all these other proteins. You probably won't know that, and you're going to include particles like this in your 3D reconstruction. So that will certainly limit your resolution. It's all based on the specimen, the biochemistry, and understanding the composition of your sample. So as I said, impurities may have about the same size as your object of interest, and I have to say there are many times where even on a gel, we'll have a beautiful band by Kamasi, you know, by analytical SEC, a nice peak, and we look at it in the microscope, it looks like someone sneezed on the grid. And it's very frustrating when that happens. I suspect it's happened to many in the audience. And then I'll just make a couple comments. Flexibility. Of course, there's this idea that we're able to look at conformations as would exist in solution, so we obviate the problems about crystal packing forces in 3D crystallography or the unusual conditions, very, very high concentrations used in NMR spectroscopy. But even so, if you can't see an important functional region of your structure, you still have no information, even if it isn't a native conformation. And conformational changes, of course, looking at frozen specimens, we can use physiologic buffers, and exemplified beautifully by Nigel's lecture last night. But, you know, in many instances, the conformational changes may be on just the order of a few angstroms, such as in the acetylcholine receptor. And I just wanted to point out a paper that Anchi Cheng published trying to propagate errors in 2D crystallography so that you really do know what the variance is in 3D maps, which is essential for doing difference map analysis. And Pavel has done a similar analysis for single particles. I think there's been a discussion about error propagation. That'll become more and more important as we're starting to look at shifts of helices on the order of 1, 1.5, 2 angstroms. A lot of discussion about complex omics. In fact, I've applied for a couple of grants myself where you grind up a cell and you're going to purify all the complexes. And I think that we'll have to find ways to label specific species that we're hoping to isolate, identified either by two hybrid methods or mass spec. And David mentioned the possibility of trying to use molecular biology to incorporate labels. I think that will become more and more important. But even so, I really wonder if this should be the future of our field, the analog of structural genomics, but in electron microscopy. And lastly, I just want to point out that, again, I want to be provocative here. I think we're looking at the tip of the iceberg, that 90% of cell biology involves low-affinity interactions, that often you'll have a kinase, I call it kiss and run. So you have cytoplasmic tails of an integrin, a kinase comes and plants a phosphate, and all of a sudden you have this cascade of signaling that culminates in changes in gene transcription and the whole metabolism of the cell changes. I think if you really want to explore those things, we'll have to devise other ways to trap these complexes on the fly, and I don't think we're there yet. So the good, the outstanding, I would say that none of the subunit structures could have been solved as single particles. Be curious if any of you disagree with me. And the bad, why didn't these clever methods developed a decade ago achieve general applicability? There's a lot of hope for 2D crystallography of membrane proteins because you are in a native lipid bilayer. Why is it that we haven't been able to reliably grow 2D crystals? Monolayer crystallization, you'll hear much of the wonderful work that Liz has done in this area. She'll elaborate. But here again, why isn't it a technique that, why hasn't that been of greater general applicability? There's a lot of interest on using icosahedral viruses as templates for insertion of structures of unknown proteins. One example is Phoebe Stewart's analysis of adenovirus with an ectodomain of an integrin. It was very similar to what happens in cells in that it bound the fivefold site, the vertex position in adenovirus, but it was just sort of a blob. You couldn't see anything. And the hope is that by somehow leveraging icosahedral processing that you'd be able to get to higher resolution. Of course, there was only one integrin, not five, at the fivefold vertex, so you're averaging all that density. But in general, I think these sorts of fusions have not been successful. I think Bettina worked very hard on inserting modules into the surface of hepatitis B, inserting GFP, I think, and she was never able to see secondary structure. And again, Liz will talk more about lipid nanotubes and what has and hasn't been realized there. So I think more effort should be devoted to generating specimens that form symmetric assemblies. And I just point out Brian Kabilka's efforts on the beta adrenergic receptor, paper in Nature, two papers in Science. And the protein was modified as follows. The carboxy tail was flexible, so that was removed. Glycosylation sites were removed because of conformational flexibility. Some phosphorylation sites were removed, but not all. And then Brian knew from FRET studies that there were two helices that seemed to move away from the protein more as it started to unfold. And so he stabilized the third cytoplasmic loop by sort of trimming it away and then inserting T4 lysozyme, which was really important for stabilizing the protein and very important for crystal contacts. And then the palmitoylation sites were not removed. They were maintained. And as you look at the structure, it's beautiful in that the dimer interface is not mediated by protein-protein interactions. It's actually the palmitoylation sites clustered with cholesterol molecules. I think it's fascinating. And I actually wonder if that might be some general theme in the GPCRs and how they interact with each other. And, of course,
Ray's going to give a talk on this.
Oh, good. And there were very important technical factors. And in fact, Brian told me that it was Gebhard Schertler that suggested that it was really worthwhile to use microbeam X-ray crystallography at the synchrotron. And then Vadim in Ray Stevens' lab brought cubic lipids to Scripps via Martin Caffery, and that was critically important for high resolution. Just an example where the sample made all the difference in the success of this project. So last night we were at dinner discussing all these issues, microscopes, samples, imaging, drift, beam damage. And, you know, was very confident. He has a very productive laboratory and has also pioneered many of the techniques that we use routinely. And then Ken was talking about spot scan imaging, and Waz done some work in that area too. And then finally, out of frustration, Ken just said, well, you must have some rate limiting step. And Waz's answer was money. And I would have imagined that Yoshi's reply would have been, I don't know. And with that, I will pass the microphone to Liz.
We're going to quit talking to you.
So, Mark, in terms of using icosahedral viruses as sort of templates for ordering things, have the entire fab fragment of a decorated virus ever been seen?
At high resolution? Where you can actually see the individual beta strands?
Well, no.
That's what we want.
And so, you have to recall the affinity. Was it against a loop?
In general, you have to use monoclonal antibodies. Sometimes you'll get some density using polyclonals, but because of the epitope distribution, you'll never see strong density.
But on the same, I also have a poster outside, but I also don't see any secondary structure.
Yeah. But long ago, we collaborated with Jack Johnson and Annette Schneeman to insert seven amino acids, which turned blockhouse virus into a wonderful immunogen for foot and mouth disease virus. And in the reconstruction, we see this little mountain of density there. It's there, but
yes, that's
we
exactly
get no information. We get the same
exactly
information from Western blot.
We did the cooperation with our clinical park in Mainz, and it's a tumor vaccine, or the attempt of doing this. And it seems to work with mouse model, and we tried to characterize it by 3D reconstruction just because the particles look so cute.
Yes.
But we see everything, the alpha helices and the spikes and everything. It's very nice, but the very tip, it's a blob.
All right. Well, Liz will tell us about some symmetric systems that have wonderful results.
I don't know about that. Well, I don't have to explain anything about how the lipid monolayer system works, because Debbie explained that yesterday. And I just will just give you some of the experiences I had working with the system to form 2D arrays. And I'll spend a little bit more time talking about how we use lipid nanotubes as substrates for helical crystallization. And at the end, I'll just give you one example of how we use lipid layers to look at a large oligomeric complex to get some structural information. So this is just some of the crystals that have been crystallized on the monolayer over the last 20 years. I couldn't include all of them. And I was actually involved very early on. Actually, it's more than 15 years ago, but I don't like to admit I'm over 50. So I was involved in helping to crystallize the first E. coli RNA polymerase structure and the yeast Pol2. And these structures, like Debbie said, there hasn't been many done in ice, and these were actually done in negative stain, but they give us a good glimpse of what the molecule looks like, and actually those 3D maps were very similar in shape to the atomic structures, which took another 10 years to solve. And actually working with work that we did helped the crystallographers. I need to point out something that Mark also said about stabilizing the protein. The E. coli RNA polymerase core enzyme didn't crystallize, whereas the holo enzyme that has the sigma factor bound did crystallize, give better crystals. And with the Yeast-Pol2, we had to have a mutant made from Al Edwards that was lacking subunits 4 and 7, which are really small but are dissociable from the enzyme. And that then, when we used that protein, we got much nicer crystals and we were able to get the 3D maps. And of course, there's like several more structures of the polymerases from Roger Kornberg's lab and other labs that should be on this list, but you know, it would go on all the way down the floor. And there's been several from Ken Taylor's lab on different myosins, so I just put up a few examples. When I was working on these proteins, I used streptavidin as a model protein to try and improve the transfer method, as it's a big problem in all 2D crystallization, and especially with the lipid monolayers. And as you'll notice, this group of proteins have been crystallized using specific lipids and also some ligands. The first one up here is also, of course, the pioneering work that Roger Kornberg did with Ed Yuskaris to start this whole method. And he had to make a dinitrophenyl lipid head group to bind the antibody against it. And you can imagine making a specific lipid every time you wanted to look at a protein is going to be very labor-intensive. So when I left Roger's lab and I started thinking about that, and I joined Pat Brown's group, and at that time it was actually still 1992, and just histag proteins were just becoming really popular at that time. And I discussed with Pat, why don't we just try putting that nickel chelating head group on a lipid? And I thought it would be easy. And so I used HIV reverse transcriptase as a model protein. So what did I learn from these model proteins? So I learned that streptavidin crystals could be transferred onto homogeneous hydrophobic grids much better than they could be transferred to just the regular grids that you have left lying around. But that was really tricky to make these grids. And if anybody's interested, I can tell you about it later. But it's basically you're alkylating the grid. But then when I just tried to put down a holy grid and lift the crystals up, then it got even higher efficiency. Went from 50 to 100. So ended up sticking with the holy grids and stopped using the alkylated grids. But I think listening to all these different talks, maybe we should actually be thinking of ways of getting homogeneous hydrophobic grids. I think, what did I want to say after that? So this was just an example is a very old picture, obviously, and there's been better ones done since then of streptavidin. And I just wanted to let you know that you can, these over the holes, it does go to high resolution. These diffraction points are like out to 3 angstrom resolution. And you may say, okay, this is just streptavidin, but I think we heard from Debbie that in the Ken Taylor group, they've done several reconstructions from proteins that have been spanning over holes. And so for some proteins, it works. But for RNA polymerase, actually, it didn't work. It didn't span over the holes. And the loop method worked a little bit, too. And, you know, Francisco actually published a paper showing how beautifully he could transfer the Pol2 crystals using the loop method. So I think there's a number of different ways to transfer crystals. And then I just wanted to show you that this is also a very old and historic moment for me, but it was very exciting because I finally got the HIV reverse transcriptase to crystallize on nickel lipids. It took me a couple of years because I tried to make the lipid myself and finally ended up, okay, I'm not a very good chemist, so collaborated with Avanti. So this is just a diffraction pattern. Is actually covering the boxed area of the monolayer, or it's not really a monolayer, but it's a lipid layer where 2D arrays were formed. And this method also has been continued and improved. And you know, Hervé Celia worked with MHC, and I also was a little bit involved at the beginning of that. And 2D arrays of MHC class 1 also can be transferred over to Holy Grids, and they diffracted out to 3 angstrom resolution. So it's not a problem with crystal order. And Gervais Moser and Daniel Levy and Catherine from Vineen Bryan, they all have done a lot of work with the nickel lipids, and Gervais and Daniel Levy showed that you can use it actually to crystallize membrane proteins. So I think there's a lot of advances that, you know, I think there's still a lot of work that can be done in this with the monolayers. But as you all know, that, you know, working with 2D crystals have is a challenge. And, you know, collecting all these tilt images is a daunting task. And actually, since I worked with Nigel and now I'm working in Ron's group, I actually disagree with Richard, and I think that working with helices is a good way to go. And so I thought if you could adapt all the positive things that this method has helped us to crystallize proteins for and use it for crystallizing on lipid nanotubes. So, like, what are the advantages of using these kind of substrates? Well, now a lot of the advantages have already been explained by Nigel. You don't have to tilt your specimen. And I'll come back to this point, but it's really easy to make these lipid nanotubes. And we have the advantage that it has a bilayer, so you can bind, just like the monolayers, you can bind proteins that normally would bind to the membrane. And I think this is, like, one of the major advantages of using this. It's like, you know, you don't have the transfer problem. You can make these tubes, and they're in an Eppendorf, and you just put a drop on the grid. And you can, you know, take your tube anywhere you want. If you want to put it in your pocket to warm it up, I've done that, you know, and just, like, try all different things. And then you just put a drop on the grid, and you can stain it or freeze it. So I think that's a really good advantage. And I just wanted to quickly say that to make them are really easy. You can buy these lipids now from Avanti, and this is the tube-forming lipid. And you can dope it with a lipid of choice, a charged lipid or a nickel lipid, and then at different ratios, then you dry it down under argon. You can resuspend it in a buffer of choice. You vortex it or sonicate it, and voila, you get your tubes. So this is a negative stain grid of nickel lipid tubes, and they are about 27 nanometers in width, and they vary in length up to several microns. This is just a fluorescent picture. It's actually a GFP. It's not a fluorescent picture. It's a GFP his tag that's bound to nickel tubes. And I thought that, you know, if anyone wants to advance this method, it might be helpful to use as a high throughput method for, like, screening proteins that are tagged with GFP. And so instead of having to do EM on them all the time, you could quickly check your samples with the light microscope. This is just two examples. I wanted to show these ones because they're big and the people in the back of the room can probably see the molecules. They may not be the best ordered, but you can also order very large complexes on these nanotube substrates. These are both on charged nanotubes. This is a chaperonin, a thermophilic chaperonin, and it's actually got 18 subunits. And it's a megadalton in size. So you have 9 subunits on top, and then it's a double, it's like a barrel. And it's 180 angstroms long. These are not at the same scale, sorry. This is the heptameric pore of the protein that forms the heptameric pore from anthrax toxin that allows the edema and lethal factor to go into the cell and kill it. And this was done on a charged tube, and I just wanted to mention here that this protein has a lot of histidines at the end where it would normally bind on the membrane, and actually found that you could get crystals of this protein also on a nickel lipid that has not been histagged. So I think you have to be a little bit careful with the nickel lipid because there is many proteins that will bind to nickel lipid that are not histagged. This is just a list of some of the things, and they're mostly just trial things that I managed to form arrays on and different types of tubes. So on the nickel lipid tubes, crystallized a couple of antibodies, and propyngealized. I'm just going to talk a bit more about that one. biotin lipid tubes. It makes up between biotin tube or biotinylated lipid tubes. Streptavidin, of course, Chris does form arrays, and I use streptavidin and PFO as model proteins to study the utility of this method a bit further. And then there's been a number that I've looked at on charged tubes and negatively charged lipid tubes. So this is just a picture showing the streptavidin in vitreous eyes that it diffracts quite nicely. And I'm not going to talk much more about streptavidin, but we did a 3D reconstruction of both wild type and a mutant streptavidin. And working with both streptavidin and PFO, I had similar experiences. So I'm going to talk a little bit, just because nobody knows what preferential lysin is, I'm just going to quickly tell you. It's a pore-forming toxin secreted by the Clostridium perfringens, and it's a major cause of gastroenteritis. It's a member of the cholesterol-dependent cytolysins like streptolysin and listeriolysin you're more familiar with. And the monomeric form of perfringial lysin binds to the cell membrane, and they form these large oligomeric pores that punch holes, basically, in the cell membrane and kills the cell. And I use this one also because we have an atomic structure. If you're doing a model system, you should have an atomic structure to check it with. And we put the His tag at the C-terminus of the PFO that is near hydrophobic loops that would normally bind to the cell membrane. So this is an example of sort of things that we got from the nickel lipid tubes bound with His-tagged perfringial lysin. And they had lots and lots of arrays on them, but it was actually only small areas that would diffract really well. So we had a wild-type version that formed pores, and we had a mutant version that didn't form pores. It was only one amino acid change. But both of these showed the same. There was a lot of variability, and even with these small segments, if you collected a lot of them, there would be several helical families within this. So there's a lot of problems still to be solved. And, you know, we did try different things to try and get better long-range order, like maybe adding detergents. I can discuss that later if you're interested. But even if you have a lot of short segments, and if you have maybe even automation, you use automation, I think there's a possibility that you can still use this method. And we did do a map of several of these segments together. And so it is possible to get a three-dimensional map. And we could tell that the PFO was forming head-to-head dimers on the lipid substrate. But really, what we need to study, because this is a large oligomeric pore, and that's what's interesting. So we went back to lipid layer again and looked, and you can see that these pores are all different sizes, so it would never form crystals. So this is a good one to look at on lipid layers. And I'm just going to point out one quick thing here. So to figure out a way to orient the PFO monomers, we did site-specific bitinylation and decoration with streptavidin. And that was something Mark brought up. You know, I think it's important to start thinking of different ways of labeling your protein. I just wanted to quickly show the result of that. So with a residue that we knew would bind to the outside, we know that because of the atomic structure and many other biophysical methods. This residue was then mutated to cysteine, and the cysteine was bitinylated, and then you can bind streptavidin. I think you can see that the streptavidin is binding to the outside of the pore, so we know which side of the monomer is binding is on the outside. And then with a predicted residue that should be in the luminal side, we actually found that the streptavidin was labeling in the inside. So it's a pretty nice thing you can do on lipid layers. So my message to all this is that no single method is going to work for every protein. And so I think we all have to keep on working on different methods and not just say, okay, you know, 2D crystals are hard, so we'll just give up. Helicals are hard, so we'll just give up. We'll just all go to single particles, which I think is good, and we should when it's appropriate. But I think that we should still keep on developing new methods. And I think having a combination of methods is really going to be what we need to solve more protein and protein complexes. Is that in 10 minutes? Tried really hard.
So I think one of the labs that has had phenomenal success with this method is Kent Taylor's lab, and I wondering if Ken would like to say a few words about how easy it is and why it's easy in your lab and everyone else finds it really difficult.
Sadly, it's actually not all that easy. It's easy. It's easy for me because I don't do anything. But I'll tell you some of our experiences that may help you out, and I'm hoping somewhere down the line I'll be able to give you an answer to where we've had problems. But we first started doing this tech. Shut me up if I ramble on, but you only gave me a few minutes to prepare. So we first started doing this technique when I was at Duke, and if you were to ask Liz about this technique, I'm sure that she would say you need a system that always works, so that if it goes south, you know you got problems. So with us, it was forming actin rafts. I think with her, it would be streptavidin. And so we started, as soon as I heard about that, I said, well, we need to work on this for cytoskeleton. So Diane had a specimen. She would polymerize G-actin under this lipid monolayer, and she would get these enormous rafts of F-actin. And she started learning how to incorporate actin-binding proteins. In short, the technique, just like everything she touched, turned to gold. And we moved to FSU, and everything she touched continued to turn to gold. And then they decided to remodel our building. And so we had to move out of our building, and I moved her into they gave us a temporary, they actually gave us space in an old high school that they had remodeled as part of all this thing. But in any case, so she got a room in the adjacent building, and everything was still working fine. And then we moved back into our building, and everything went south. And this is where really, you know, when you're not getting crystals, if you stop getting crystals, that's where you need that streptavidin, you know, in our case, polymerizing actin, because if that doesn't work, you know you got a problem, but you never know where the problem was. And so she has struggled actually for quite a while with making these specimens, and we still don't know why it didn't work, you know. But a colleague retired in the adjacent building, and we took over the same building, not the same lab that she had used when we were moved out. And she took over a cold room in there, and now things are working. So, and I have no idea why. Now, if you talk to anybody who's an expert in lipid monolayers, you know, they're going to tell you that you have to be very finicky. And I think that's probably why Liz and Diane are very good at this, because they pay attention to all the details, you know. But if it goes south, you know, you don't necessarily know. You all know what I mean by going south. You know, that means it capsized, went belly up. It doesn't work anymore. So, and this is a large part of what we do. So to get this room in Jason building, I had to point out to the chairman of the department. I said, well, if we can't make this work, you're pissing off $400,000 a year in direct costs. And that means $200,000 a year for you guys in indirect costs, and that moved the mountain. You know, so what I would say is try this technique, you know, with something like streptavidin or whatever is convenient for you to do that's likely to polymerize. And if it works, do not let anybody move you out of that lab. And if it does work and it's important for you, do not move anywhere else without first knowing that it works. But it's just a tricky kind of technique, because the lipids, you know, just... You don't know. The other thing about this, she was talking, is the other thing that we did, or you started to move toward me. I thought he was meaning I was shutting, so I'm just rambling. Okay. The other thing that we did when we first started off is, that I think is actually important, maybe the best thing that we ever did for this technique, was realize that you know, if you have something that really works really fast, like actin or streptavidin, you know, that's nice. But, you know, a lot of things don't crystallize right away. And so crystallization on the monolayer for a lot of specimens is a tricky kind of thing. So if you're using unsaturated lipids, the lifetime of the monolayer is probably no more than 72 hours. And so we moved to doing saturated lipids, in order to get the fluidity, we had to go to a short chain. And in order to make them insoluble, so we went to didodecyl, dimethyl ammonium. And we did almost, you can interject.
Before you, tell everybody to buy saturated lipids, they're so stable. I mean, I published this stuff, but, when we used the saturated lipid that you're talking about, I didn't get any crystals of perfringolysin. Mm-hmm. And so, and I tried doping a little bit DOPC, which is, of course, been, it's not helping because you're putting in, again, an unsaturated one. And again, it works. So we could show that, for some proteins, you really need that fluidity. And so it doesn't,
yeah, it's still. I think it's still fluid, but it may. But I think it is a finicky thing. It's crystallization, and a lot of things that we've done are floppy proteins that wouldn't crystallize well. And the only thing that really helps us, we get them down on the lipid monolayer. They have only 3 degrees of freedom, or 3 degrees of freedom rather than 6. And they float around. They'll make these arrays, not necessarily what you would put a crystallographer, X-ray crystallographer, would call a crystal, but at least they're conformationally, not so heterogeneous anymore. And it takes time for those to form. And unsaturated lipids have a tendency to oxidize. And we've even tried using argon, and that's not putting them under argon, but that doesn't seem to work. Either there's enough oxygen left around or something. But in any case, that's another tricky thing. So when we heard about the nickel lipid, then we had to get a saturated form of the nickel lipid to work in our system. So we had to ask Avani to make it for us. And, that's expensive. and I only had a bolus of money from the Cell Migration Consortium that I could buy this with. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice to work with phosphatidyl inositol. So I asked him for a quotation. So I think we paid like $22,000 for our saturated form of the nickel lipid, and they wanted $25,000 to make a tiny amount of of this. So I thought, well, perhaps we won't work on that system. So,
can you estimate your success rates? Say someone walks into your lab with a protein and hands it to Diane and says, can you crystallize this?
Over the last 3 years? That much, okay? Before that, usually pretty good. Usually pretty good. Lately she's become very finicky about who she'll take protein from. And so certain people she will do anything for them, and other people she won't touch their stuff. That's the finicky part.
Does anyone else have experience with lipid layer crystallization or this sort of technique that they want to make some comments about?
So I've had experience of putting the his tag on the NRC terminus, and that can make a big difference. If mm-hmm. you switch it around, you get crystals on one termini and not on the other. And so I think there's a lot of ways that you can get the crystals. It's not just the method. I mean, it's not the method that's the problem. I think it's a lot of times it's a sample. And, I think that the method certainly needs to be improved and worked on, but I think really we have to think about the sample, and you can make a lot of changes.
Yeah, the thing, but what one person calls a crystal, it's not necessarily what another person. See, what I would call a crystal, I'm sure Yossi would call crap. Yeah, now that's a crystal. Yeah, the rest of it is just arrays.
So I think that it could be done.
Yeah, none of our stuff has ever gone 10 angstroms. I think is the best we've ever done. But none of our stuff that you would really call a good candidate for crystallization anyway. So it's basically floppy stuff.
Question by Todd, just what dot does it make difference if I continue two of these tags at different positions? So I would anchor the protein at two positions and the monolayer. That kind of a
Well, I had experience trying to crystallize for a long time on any unsensitive factor. And it's a hexamer, it has a his tag on each one. And I think that probably prevents it from crystallizing because it's really anchoring it there and maybe not in the position that it wants to crystallize. And so I think we found that with the DNA polymerase, I think that definitely the site is important. And if you anchor it to a certain point where it just can't have that, it's not in the place where the way it wants to interact with each other. I mean, a lot of people have had more success using the charge with this layer because maybe the specific orientation is not the one that the protein wants to crystallize. So I don't
So we do have to, she uses, we use precipitants. Of course, you can't use high salt because it's, if it's a charge interaction, but she uses PEG, she uses, you know, various things. It's essentially crystallization by, you know, another, you know, like you would be doing for 3D stuff. So, you know, and it's, you have to play around. If you're lucky, gosh, you know, the right thing will just make it right away. And the wrong thing takes a little fiddling, you know. And the other thing, which I really can't emphasize enough, is the pickup. You know, and I think that's probably a lot of maybe where our problems were. Is, but a lot of things can affect the pickup, and I think it's not just the grids. So, you know, but the whole, I mean, the whole, we do everything on holy grids. That was, I thought, the wonderful invention, however, whether you did deliberately or by happenstance, but the holy grids are the, you know, that's the big efficient thing. And as Debbie showed, you know, you could, with the holy grids, you can make these specimens, and you can freeze these. By the way, you know, absolutely, you can freeze these lipid monolayer specimens and make great grids. You can't normally see the crystals in the holes, but you can just take pictures. You know, you could take low mag pictures of the hole, transform it, just like she said. So you should be able to collect data real easily, because the efficiency of pickup with these holy grids is really good.
I want to make a
point. In our experience.
Yeah. I think that it's going to be dependent on the packing. It's like with RNA polymerase, being a lot of solute in between, mm-hmm. and intermolecular contact is going to be important. And so if you have something that doesn't have a lot of intermolecular contact, it's probably not going to be helpful.
Okay, two more questions, and then we'll move on. Linda?
Gosh, I don't know. Well, I think the main problem is screening, you know, because you have to destroy the sample to screen it. You know, it's not like you're taking a sample out of a membrane protein crystallization. You see, when you pick up your thing, it's never going to get any better because it's all gone once you've so some method of figuring out whether you had arrays on your surface without having to put the grid on would be useful, I think. I mean, technology for this is trivial, and if you're very, and when I say finicky, you know, with monolayers, you have to be bare, very clean. You got to be careful with what you do, with everything like that. So, I mean, if you're a careful person, you could pick this up, and if it works for you, you know, God, you might have the rest of your career lined up. But if you're sloppy, I suggest you don't try it. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's what she mentioned.
So
but I no, we don't. I mean, but we more or less do what Debbie described the other night. You know, you don't want to glow discharge your grids. You know, you keep them clean because if they got oil or stuff on them, it may never pick up the monolayer. But you keep them clean, and you want them good and hydrophobic. And if you do, they'll come up and they'll make the whole grid hydrophilic. And then you block from the grid bar side. Reason we do this because monolayers are very delicate. You don't want anything to touch it because they can diffuse on surface. But this whole thing's hydrophilic because it just draws off the water and you're left. I mean, I just can't tell you just how good these grids are. We have never done six or seven 3D reconstructions of ice-embedded 2D arrays. We could have never done that if we didn't have, you know, if we didn't have a good efficient pickup method and a good way of making frozen specimens, you know, because if the pickup is inefficient, you know, 20%, and the good ice is 20%, 20% times 20% is, takes a high threshold of pain. So see, you'll never ask me to speak spontaneously again, will you?
Okay, we're going to finish off the session with Ben Sams, who wants to make some comments.
Well, comments, I think primarily what I would like to do is wake you up again. So, yeah, when Ron asked me to speak in the specimen discussion panel section, I was really relieved because, you know, to me, quantum mechanics and detector efficiency all sounds like exotic workout options at your local gym. But being a biochemist by training, so that talking about specimen is actually something that I've been thinking about for quite some time. It doesn't mean that necessarily everything that comes out there is a drop of wisdom, okay? So there's a lot of, well. So what I want to do to start this off is actually, we have heard about this humongous database. So let's create a little database at the beginning of this exercise here. How many people in the room are at the moment actively solving a structure? All right. Okay. That's good. You know, just leave your arms up and everybody look around so you get a sort of feeling for the B factor that's involved here. as we go along with that experiment. So the next question I have for all of you that have the arm up, okay, is how many of you work daily on ordered specimens? On ordered specimens like 2D crystals. Okay? You can take your hands down. Okay, so everybody who does not work on an ordered specimen, they still have their hands up? Like single particles, tomograms, whatever. So anything that is not ordered, like in the sense what we heard before. So that is still the majority. Now, the question here I have for you is, how many of you do nothing else but thinking of how you can actually improve your samples? And how many of you just hanging on for bare life, hoping to get this published, whatever it is you look for? Leave alone the question whether what you're going to publish has anything to do with the truth behind it. Right? So facing this sort of mental exercise, I wasn't thinking, all right, let's just come from a different angle here when we talk about specimen and, you know, how would I start this off? So the first, I want to start it with an apology because if I ruffled somebody, you know, somebody's feathers in the room, it's not personal, all right? it's just for show effect, to keep you going, right? And by all means, if they're ruffled, stand up and shout, right? Make a noise and come out for the duo. You know, it will be fun. Huh? Well, that would be ideal, actually. You know, so 100% what detection efficiency, so sort of ruffling efficiency. I think, you know, that would earn me some praise. But anyhow, so where I wanted to go, I was thinking. So let me give you a good example. When I look at my 17 years or whatever I have spent in EM, looking back at the field and what I see sort of emerging there as trend over this relatively short time period. And a good example for this is what happens in the, I'm being Catholic, I can say that. What happens is a Roman Catholic Church about two or three times every century, they have one of these intractable tasks that they have to do, the bishops are talking about, they have to elect a new pope. And the question is, how do they do this? Well, it's a very simple answer. They lock themselves into a room and they will not leave that room until it's over. Right? Now, when we talk about specimen, that is actually what we should be doing right now. We should be locking those doors and saying, nobody gets dinner. Until we have come up with some sort of intelligent thing to say about it, right? And, you know, I do not agree with Ron. I do think at the specimen side there is a fair amount of work that needs to be done. But, you know, why would I bring this example, and what does that have to do with electron microscopy? Well, if you look at the early days of microscopy, those people like Richard and David, and they had a problem. They had an image and say, what the hell does that mean, and how can I use this? And they were very focused on trying to working these issues out, how to get the basic structural data out of the images. And then there was a little technology problem that the microscope weren't quite really good enough. And then today, if we look around and say, so what are actually the fronts on which we have to fight our war? This is not like one fire, several fires. Is a specimen, is a technology, is a computing. So there is a dilution factor, because the field, just in terms of man hours that we can put in, is not growing fast enough. But I think that is not really all that is limiting us as a field at any level, right? And you can be optimistic about it, and you can be pessimistic. So if you look first at the technological issues that we have heard about in the past 2 days, like the detectors and everything, there is still the same group of people that were together and at the front of that a long time ago. Well, I shouldn't have said that. If that ruffles you, please, okay? So they have been there from the very beginning of the field, actually, and where it was said first night, what an awesome experience to actually have these people all in the same room again talking. And they're still talking about these physical things. So if you're optimistic about this, you would say they will solve all the problems while they're still around. If you're more realistic and pessimistic, you'll say, probably that ain't going to happen. Now, from my point of view, is where are sort of the people that are like me getting close to their midlife crisis and younger than that, that are drawn into the physical problems of our field? And the number is less than 5 that I would know of, all right? So I think at some point we will have to deal with the specimens, because we know that the technology no longer will improve, because the EM field just failed to attract the type of people that will be required to do more than messy biology, not including myself, you know, sort of the biology. So that is the one part. And if you look at the automation issue, you know, my scariest experience was when I first had learned how to put a cryo-holder into the microscope, going to a Gordon conference, seeing Bridget there in the midday sun with sunglasses, you know, talking a beer, talking about automation. And I said, shh, you know? There, I was so proud to be one of maybe 25 students on the planet that learned how to do this. So I saw, you know, the big Roy's house and everything, you know, wealth. And there she talks about automating me away, all right? Then you see the drift in the microscope, and you contemplate that. You say, well, watching this drifting or do something useful. So I'm now a full fan and supporter of automation, as Bridget knows. And if you look how amazing the progress is that has been done, again, in automation, over the past, 5 years, 6 years? Right? That is really breathtaking, okay? Where it comes really to the point that you say, if you continue improving that at that rate, there won't be a renewal for your resource because it will be done, right? So that's really, but what I want to say here is it's not a threat. It's basically just trying to say it's the same thing. They're locked in, and they're not going to get out of the room until it's done. So what I'm talking about is focus. And if we look at the specimen side, there, to me, as an observer of the field internal, the situation is just completely different. And you can best describe it by a lack of focus and migration. Right? And the migration behavior there is like birds, is that there were first 2D crystals, and then people realize there's a limited number of samples that we can use this for. It's difficult. So what Liz was getting at the end. So people found out, ooh, there's single particle. So everybody migrated to single particle, right? And now, you know, we sort of realize, well, single particle is maybe not exactly trivial either. And what happens? The majority of the people floats towards tomography, because that is just, but that is what you know. If you pull out the program of the last 2 Gordon conferences and you plot the number of tomography talks as a function of time, you'll actually see that there's this exponential rise for absolutely no good reason other than that it can be done. Right?
I mean, there is so much you can answer with single particle. There's so much you can answer with 2D crystallography. Yet, like a phase separation, it gets pushed away because everybody is enjoying the latest toy, right? And that is not trying to diminish the tomography is tremendously important. It will answer tremendously important questions. But at the moment, it's the last field standing that's unregulated and still will get you the cover of Science. With something where you have no reason to justify what it is you've been doing, all right? To a certain extent. A little bit overdrawing the line, but I think the sort of gusset is correct. And I say, okay, my prediction is that 5 years from now, people will realize, well, maybe tomography is not exactly either, right? And at that point, what are we going to do then? So we have basically exhausted. Exactly. Exactly. So that is where it will come full circle, or where people at least will face up and say, okay, now we have done all the easy things, and we actually have to roll up our sleeves and get busy down into the dirty ditches and start dealing with things that are unresolved at the specimen sample level. And so here it is. Now we go into our conclave. We lock ourselves in and think specimen and nothing but specimen. So what would we do? So where is it? You know, I mean, I'm sometimes getting sick of hearing this all worked great with GrowEL, and you know, this of course, you know, if it doesn't work with GrowEL, you know, then don't even talk about it. All right. But you know, what we really want to do is we want to use all these technologies for the small particles like 100 kilodalton, 150 kilodalton, 200 kilodalton, right, with flexibility. And one thing that I've heard has been brought up a couple of times, but never really gets pursued, why not, is, so how do we validate any of these things? I mean, now we have occasionally examples popping up where people look at the exactly same specimen with different approaches or different hands or whatever, they get different answers. And instead of sitting together and sorting it out, they just said, well, the others, they got it wrong. You know, sort of. That is not exactly productive and can use improvement. But, you know, so what would it be that at a single particle specimen level we would want to do to guarantee that we give to the biologists out there that are interested in answering questions that are cell biological, would give them the confidence that what we show them has actually some meaning, right? And the one idea to me is that you can do a lot of the computational level, certainly, but the one thing is that you say, if you were asked personally now, on the spot, to answer, what is your favorite little verification tag that you would put on a big complex, a small domain, something, okay, that you reconstruct together like baggage, you know, the rest of your complex, but we know exactly what the structure is, and we have an internal control that if our reference point comes out wrong, I wouldn't trust the rest either, right? And then you hear these arguments saying, yeah, but, you know, you put this on your complex and this may interfere with function. It may be, you know, too flexible. It may be all these things, and it makes me sick because, yes, of course, like we saw yesterday, occasionally it rains in Southern California. But, you know, our field, I have the feeling whenever it gets really difficult, except for certain exceptions, right, gets incredibly conservative, anti-risk, and simply just lazy, trying avoidance behavior, you know, sort of like in conditioning, trying to run away from the problem. You know, many of these things we have to try. So what would we want to do? Every one of you thinking about your favorite molecules. What I'm looking for as a validation tag is something, let's say 10 kilodaltons, has a structure that is characteristic at 20 angstrom, 15 angstrom, and better than 10 angstrom. So it should have something in the structure that at each level of resolution, I don't mind what the exact number is, but at each level of resolution gives me an internal checkpoint that says, done, okay? I see it, as it has the right hand, it has the right number of repeats, it has about whatever, okay? So that is what we should be thinking about, in my opinion, when we talk about single particle reconstructions. Can we come up with a collection of small domains that we can put on like purification tags, that if you combine them with genomic and random insertion and functional screening complementation assays will give us a set of molecules that we can construct, and we can have some sort of a sense for the asymmetric thing, how good it is, because we know that our positive control that's attached to the very thing we have reconstructed looks like it's supposed to look like. It also would give us an assessment of internal B factors, because if the helices or whatever is in that structures are blurred out or whatever, you know, so it would make discussing our cases a lot easier.
Do you have an example? Do you have an example in mind?
Well, the one that we explore in my lab are TPR repeat motifs, right? They're 20 angstrom, 20 nanometer long rods, a beautiful helical. The one we use is thermostable to 150 degrees. Okay, so it's perfectly, it's very rigid and will help your alignment. It will do all sorts of good things, but you know, it needs some work being put in there to actually look at how useful it turns out. And 85-90% of the things you try will just wind up in the shredder. Okay, zoom, there I go, down the toilet, and that was it. Okay, but that doesn't mean that it's not important to be done. And I think that is one, as a community, where I think, are we really supportive of the people that stick their neck out and try to do these things? And my answer is no, we are not. All right? Especially the younger people, as you, Ron, pointed out, we still have to survive. We want tenure, we want money, we want fame, you know, all the sorts that all the people already have. You know, so some of the things we can do, some of the things we can't. But I also see structural problems in the field, that there is no infrastructure in the field to really support the people that are willing to put in the groundwork to do this type of thing, that they still would get the support that makes them survive in the overall system and keeps them competitive. The other thing that I thought is that when we talk about specimen, is something, I'm a lazy person at heart. You know? Maybe that's why I did my postdoc down here. So my dream is that you say, well, if you look at genomics, they tell you that the yeast cell has, on average, 2,000 copies of whatever complex you're interested in. A single milliliter of yeast has what? 5 times 10 to the 6 cells, if it's not too thick a culture. That means we have 5 billion copies of what we want. And that means if we talk about specimen preparation, and we start straying away from using a single milliliter of starting sample, we're thinking in the wrong direction, right? And that is sort of what Debbie brought up yesterday. You know, I would actually personally prefer if you push it even one further, right? Forget about the monolayers. I want to have a smart EM grid that allows me to bust up the cells, spin out the debris, stick my grid in with whatever magic thing is on the surface, go have a cigarette break and a beer, come back, you know, vitrified, and have a 3 millimeter by 3 millimeter 2D crystal, because that would reduce my data collection to about 4 hours and gives me a 5 angstrom structure of whatever was found there on the grid within 24 hours. You know, that would be perfect. Right? Of course, that is not going to happen, but, you know, if you always say it's not going to happen, then we don't even start walking. Right? And that is what I would accuse the EM field on a hold responsible to, that at the specimen front, we too timid. We do not allow ourselves to just walk and address the issues because we're afraid of the failure that comes along with it. Right? And I think that, in my perspective, is something, it doesn't change. Then 5 years from now, we're all out of business. Right? Because NIH at some point will say, well, we pumped billions of dollars into you people because there were some people that promised us in 1995 that every single particle will be atomic by 2005. Now it's 2025, and you haven't even hit the nanometer level with your asymmetric things yet. Wouldn't that be embarrassing? I mean, that's embarrassing for us because we will still be around at that point. You know? And say, you have quite a point there, right? But then we move on. Yeah, so, but anyway, you were.
But they're very high-risk experiments, and in this sort of financial climate, we, you know, we can't afford to divert a lot of funds towards these high-risk experiments. I mean, I agree with you, but I mean, the reality of the situation is that, you know, we have to get our grants renewed.
No, I understand that.
If it doesn't work.
But I understand that. But you know, if I want to become president, I have to run a campaign. Okay. I will not do it off my salary that I have right now, you know, no matter how much people would be donating to it. But the thing is that you say, once we're smart enough and realize that somebody needs to shoot the president and we need to bring a new one in and that needs to be... So once you have this all sorted out, okay, it still doesn't take you out that you say that we realize we need public relation managers that are actually start making noise in the right quarters so that either funding becomes available or that you get access to philanthropy that you know, says whether I spend it on this or that, I don't care, you know, as long as it's well spent. So the question really becomes, SAEM, if we want to improve this, it's not just dibbling in our little labs and, you know, push a button here and push a button there. It's really also how do we politically present ourselves, and that is as much part of specimen improvement as actually standing at the bench holding a pipette and looking good in the photo that's taken for your homepage. Right?
Well, I mean, is it a question of priorities? Because, you know, right now there's a ton of money going into the field. You know, you can buy, there are people buying $4 or $5 million microscopes and things like that.
Unfortunately, yeah. Well, because, you know, I mean, so when I set up it, yeah, you know, I was asking Richard, and that was probably one of the few times I listened and paid attention to what he was telling me. So I should apologize for that, Richard, but, you know. but, you know, I mean, that was very smart. So he, when I was asking him, so tell me, what microscope should I be buying, right? And then he said, well, you know, you might be better off if you buy something more modest and not come out and, you know, all the big machines, because the people there, after 3 or 4 years, they will just turn around, smile at you, and say, so what did you do with the investment? And, you know, at that point, you just grab your stuff and run, you know, because you know what's next, okay, and you don't want to hear it. And that is really why I say, you know, buying microscope is all wonderful, right? But if the results that these microscopes produce are not keeping up with what the expectations are out there, and if you have biologists increasingly saying, well, this cryo-EM stuff, you know, all these blobs, what does that mean anyway, okay? Then I think we do have a problem, okay? Then you have beautiful microscopes and no usage for that.
No, I guess that's what I'm saying, but I mean, the money is there, I think, in the field. It's how do you set.
But what does what do I use a Titan for, okay, if I have a sample that poops out at 50 angstrom in resolution,
saying,
okay?
I'm saying that the money is there. Do you spend it on the microscopes or... You know, to me, the whole ordering specimens looks hopeless, right?
Oh, no, but there is a difference.
So,
there is a difference.
I mean, the question, yeah, is anyone investigating doing nanopatterning with an AFM tip or something like that onto carbon on mica? So you could get your magic, you know, put in your...
Is anybody doing this?
Setting out plans to do this.
Right? Is anybody doing this, or is, you know, how many people of us on a daily basis talk to surface chemists? How many of you have talked to a surface chemist recently? Yeah, maybe that is what we should be doing, you know, at some point. It's really that we have to say, and, you know, the image processing people like Fred, and, you know, Fred, you have these wonderful collaborations with the people in San Diego, is that not right? Or where's Fred? Over there? You know, or you have also the collaboration with the engineering. So, I think a lot of this will come really by looking past our own field and say, where is expertise out there that we can tap in and exploit? Yeah, I wrap it up. There's an off button, you know, just take the micro and done. Bob.
I'm really enjoying your talk because I agree with you know, absolutely everything that you're saying.
But? It has to be there.
There is another dimension, and before I launch into it, Mark Twain, you know, apropos your earlier comments, Mark Twain once commented that he was really quite surprised when he heard through a third party that he had rubbed the fur of a friend of his the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And he said, I didn't know that he had fur. Now I've already forgotten what my real story is. The other dimension, I've got to joke a little bit. The other dimension that you haven't mentioned yet is that I think that what you're saying about specimen preparation is that
the field needs technologies that would take proteins that you're really interested in and of low molecular weight and convert them into well-ordered two-dimensional crystals.
Or pure chemistry.
But now the other parameters that are available to us are to apply single particle methods to not so well ordered two-dimensional crystals. So I want to add that to your shopping list of things that this community ought to support and ought to become engaged in. But whether you have a well-ordered crystal or only a poorly ordered crystal, you're also going to confront, we know for sure, the problem that when you start to tilt it, the Fourier transform of the image is not going to look at all like the Fourier transform of the specimen. It's going to be really bad in the third dimension. So I think that if one had a crystal, well-ordered or poorly ordered, doesn't matter, and you could count on getting data when you tilt it, then suddenly there would be a lot of people coming back to, including myself, to two-dimensional.
No, but, you know, that for example, you know, one possible solution to that problem is that why do we have to tilt? You know, everybody who's done that knows that tilting the sample is really a nuisance, actually, and painful. But if you really had a smart chemical surface that can assemble things into a 2D lattice, where a lattice doesn't necessarily mean that things have to touch. As a matter of fact, the last thing you want things to do is to touch, because then it's not a unique approach. That has to be. But that basically means if you then randomly insert whatever the handle is that assembles these things on that surface into different parts of the structure, you rotate the same thing on a perfectly isotropic lattice, so you don't have to tilt ever, okay? You just take your library of different things where you know it's in certain different orientations, and you basically just take an untilted picture, combine 10 of them, and you're done.
That's a wonderful idea, but why not solve the problem that's causing the specimen to make it difficult to tilt?
Yeah, or that. Or both.
Yeah.
But totally agree.
The nanotubes.
Yeah.
just a point. I didn't get my grant money yet. So if you don't have
which is, yeah.
Yeah, but that's tragic. But, you know, that is why I mean, no, it is. It is, you know, and that is sort of arguing against what Cliff is saying. So basically, there may be money, but there is money for microscope, because in that grant application, I can promise that I will have the cover of cell once I get my structure solved, all right? And study section members are suckers for covers, right? But if I say I will spend 4 years in the dark and produce, you know, maybe a couple of Journal of Structural Biology papers that are very solid and key to the progress of the field, very few people will really go to bat for that, okay? And I think that's tragic. That truly is tragic.
I just have one bone to pick, and this has to do with Ron describing biological damage and also the emphasis on 2D ordering of things. That what people are forgetting is that many of the more interesting things that we can look at by EM are things like conformational variability or different states that you could do by time-resolved microscopy. These are not necessarily things that you can do at high resolution. Yet at the same time, you can get good information out of it. And so I don't think it's entirely that everything should be being pushed to 2D crystals. It would be nice to get them at high resolution. But I don't think
No. I mean, and you will have all these problems of flexibility, of course, in these crystals as well. But, you know, the advantage potentially there would be is that if you had them flexible on a big lattice, you know exactly where they are, and then you can do these single particle implementations that people have been talking about. You can basically it depends to just creative thinking that's required, really, to start. Okay. Beer.